don't know if you have one of those red letter Bibles, those Bibles that show the words of Jesus, the words Jesus directly spoke in red. If you do, then you would see that the section that we've just been looking at, pretty much from chapter 13 through to the end of 17, is pretty much all red because it's all Jesus speaking. In fact, a lot of John's Gospel is Jesus speaking. But we move from that big teaching section and the prayer in chapter 17 to some more narrative interspersed with Jesus speaking. So here's a big narrative passage coming up in particularly what's to follow with the arrest, with the denials, and that all that is going on leading up to and including Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. As Mark mentioned earlier, we're taking a kind of long, slow work our way towards Easter and Easter Sunday. So it may seem that it's a bit premature that we're already looking at the arrest of Jesus, and Easter seems a long way away, only just finishing half term. But we're going to work through, as John does, all the things leading up in those final few hours to Jesus being crucified and then his glorious resurrection. So we're going to take our time as we work through that. And this morning, to that first part of chapter 18 of John. It begins, Jesus had finished praying. It might just be Jesus had finished saying. So it might be just including all those things that Jesus had been saying, both to his disciples and to his heavenly Father. Indeed, all that he'd been saying to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane that's recorded in the other Gospels. You'll remember those prayers that are recorded there as Jesus separates from the disciples and he prays, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done. So he said those things. He's finished teaching his disciples, he's finished praying, and now comes the moment for his arrest. It says that he and his disciples crossed the Kidron Valley there in verse 1. Nighttime. Don't know whether they could see it, but there would have been a full moon because it was Passover time. And they crossed this dry riverbed. It was mostly dry for most of the year, just a little bit of water in it during the winter time. And it was a riverbed that separated Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives. And as a place, this valley of Kidron was full of memories for the Jews. For one thing, they would remember that in their best times, that the good kings had taken all the rubbish of their idolatry, all the idols or all the other things that had defiled the temple, and had dumped them in the Kidron Valley. So it was about getting rid of idolatry. But I suppose most significantly, crossing the Kidron Valley was what King David, that great king, did many years before. About 1,000 years before Jesus is there, King David crosses this valley with a heavy heart. He's been betrayed by his son, Absalom, who wants to take over the kingdom. He's been betrayed by his advisor, Ahithophel, who interestingly later will hang himself. And maybe John particularly points it out because of that. Full of those memories of a great king being betrayed by his own son and by his advisor. And here is Jesus about to be betrayed, and he's a greater king, greater than David ever was, and he too crosses, maybe with a heavy heart, as he's about to be betrayed, as people will try to dethrone him. Judas appears, guiding a group of Jews and Romans. There are some people who were the sort of police for the temple, and there were also a detachment of Roman soldiers. Could have been up to 1,000 Roman soldiers. That's what the word literally means, that's used for the amount of soldiers, but maybe there were a couple of hundred soldiers who were there. They're well armed and they're well lit, aren't they? With their swords and their torches. Judas has picked the perfect situation. It's a place that he knew well. He knew Jesus would be there. He can identify Jesus there. There'll be the minimum of fuss. There won't be loads of crowds around who might cause a bit of a rumpus if Jesus is arrested. They'll just be the soldiers, and they'll just be those few people who are with Jesus. Jesus is supposed to be the criminal, of course, but he does most of the talking. He seems totally to be in command. And he offers himself for arrest. He pleads for the disciples not to be detained with him. Peter, as always, tries to solve the problem himself. He's as impulsive as ever. He uses a dagger. It's probably not a big sword that he uses, but some sort of small dagger. Commentators get a bit interested in why he cut off the left ear. Was he a very clumsy person with the way he kind of lunged? Probably, which was of interest to me as a bit of a lefty, that he was probably left-handed, which is why he cut off the right ear. So I've now alienated about 80% of you, because you're not the same as me. I'm strange and unusual. But there's a few of you who are lefties who think, oh, interesting. But maybe that was the case. Maybe it was clumsy. Maybe he was left-handed. But whatever, he tries to take things into his own hands, and he's commanded by Jesus not to do that. The other Gospels tell us that Jesus healed the man. That's probably why Peter isn't then arrested for what he does. It's a real person. He's got a name, Malchus. That's probably because John was quite familiar with many of the names and the people who worked and served in the temple. And the Jews and the Romans together now take Jesus, they arrest him, and they take him to Annas. It's a bit complicated between Annas and Caiaphas as to precisely who's the high priest, because it seemed to pass back and forward between them. Annas was very significant, whether he was literally the high priest at this moment, he was a very significant Jewish leader, and he's taken there for the first part of his trial, which we'll start to look at next time. So that's what's going on here. Let's spend a few moments thinking about what we can learn from this narrative. And the first thing is that Jesus is the all-powerful, eternal Son of God. You see, Jesus is being arrested, but John wants us to be really clear that although Jesus is being arrested, although Jesus is being betrayed, although Jesus seems to be being overpowered by this large band of people, Jesus is still completely in control. He's in command because he's still the king. He never stops being king. And he has the voice of authority. It's Jesus who comes out of the olive grove or the garden, and he asks the questions. He's really the interrogator, not them. He asks the questions because he's in command. And I suppose especially striking is verses 5 and 6, where he says, who are you looking for? Who is it you want? And then in verse 5, they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he answers back, and you just wonder how it sounded, don't you? I'm not sure I could speak it in a way that would at all do it justice. But he answers back, I am he. And when he said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Temple guard, 100 or so soldiers, fall back when Jesus just stands in front of them and says, I am he. Was it that he shouted? Was it the audacity that they didn't expect him to come out and to face them? Or was it there was something in the authority of his voice? I think God at this moment, and John sees it, God at this moment, the Father gives a particular authority to these words that are spoken by Jesus, so much so that it causes involuntarily these men to just fall back. They're so overwhelmed as Jesus speaks these words, because there has to be this moment where we can all see that he's still the King. He's still the glorious, eternal Son of God. It's a great contrast with their demand, isn't it? He says, who do you want? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. Who do they get? Jesus of Nazareth. But the great I am he. Of course, I am resonates with the name in the Old Testament for God, the name Yahweh. I am, I will be who I will be. I have always been. I'm the covenant God, so it resonated with that name, I am. But But I think particularly the words that are used and put together here for the I am he, they resonate with lots of expressions in the Old Testament prophets, particularly in the book of Isaiah. We've looked not too long ago at chapters 40 and onwards, and really from 40 through to 55, there's a number of times where God acts and God explains, and there's that expression, I am he. So we see it, for example, in Isaiah 48, verses 12 and 13. Listen to me, O Jacob, Israel, whom I have called. I am he. I am the first, and I am the last. My own hand laid the foundations of the earth, and my right hand spread out the heavens. When I summon them, they all stand up together. So John's perhaps thinking about that, the action authority of God. And he's linking it up with the I am sayings that Jesus has made throughout the Gospel of John, that John's recorded for us. I am the good shepherd. And then most recently, I am the way and the truth and the life. And then perhaps especially connecting it with what he says in chapter 8, where he's dialoguing with the Jews. And he says to them, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. You are not yet 50 years old, the Jews said to him, and you have seen Abraham. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. It's exactly the same words he uses as the words he uses here. Before Abraham was born, I am. It's just a moment when we kind of get a preview of what will happen at the end of time, when everyone will hear the voice of Jesus, the voice of authority, and every knee will bow and every tongue confess. Everybody will acknowledge, everybody will say, Jesus is King. And we just get a glimpse of it there, don't we? As Jesus says, I am. Before Abraham was born, I am. I am the great covenant-keeping God. I always was, I always will be. I'm in authority. I am he. And for that moment, all those men bow down and acknowledge it. Prostrate themselves and say, yeah, we own it for that moment. Of course, as we see, they clamber up again. It's just a passing thing for them. But it's just a glimpse of the great authority of Jesus. And it just asks the question to us, really, who do we think Jesus is? Do we think he's just Jesus of Nazareth? Or do we think he's the great I am? Do we think he's a carpenter's son who became a prominent figure and did some miracles, maybe? Or do we think he's the eternal Son of God? Do we want to have a moment where we acknowledge that maybe he's important and great? Maybe just a moment of experiencing something of his majesty and power, and then clamber up to our feet again and just carry on as normal? Or do we want to stay on our knees? And do we want to go on saying, yes, you are the eternal Son of God. Yes, you are the great I am. It's not enough, you know, just to experience a moment of the power of God. Maybe some of you have been to churches where you've had a moment of kind of experience where some phenomenon has happened to you. Something has happened. You felt something. You kind of tingled all over. Or perhaps there was some miracle that happened. You got better from an illness. Or you just had an overwhelming sense of love and it kind of gushed over you. And that was great. And maybe it was God working in your heart. But it's not enough just to have that moment of sensing something of the majesty and power of God. We need to feel it and know it and go on feeling it and know it and say with all our hearts and with all our lives, yes, you are the eternal Son of God. And that's what John wants us to do, of course. As he writes these words, as he says, I am he wants those words to echo down through the centuries and to resound in this room here and for us to hear Jesus say, I am he, and for all of us here this morning to bow down and say, yes, you are. You are the great, eternal Son of God, and I want to acknowledge that right now. Is that you this morning? You want to acknowledge that. You want to say that. And you want to go on saying that. And you say, I bow the knee and I want to stay down here. Always saying, Jesus, you are the eternal Son of God. That's the first thing then. Jesus is the eternal Son of God. But let's see also that Jesus, the eternal Son of God, is determined to go to the cross in obedience to his Father. He's determined to go to the cross to follow his Father's will. John wants to make it obvious that Jesus is completely committed to this course of action. See that in verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them. Jesus, knowing they would arrest him. Jesus, knowing they would flog him. Jesus, knowing they would take him to Calvary. Jesus, knowing he would die. Jesus, knowing all that, still comes out to face his captors. And he commands Peter to put his sword away, doesn't he? See that verse 11. Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Just occasionally in the Old Testament, the cup has an idea of blessing, a cup of blessing. But pretty much always, it's the idea of suffering. And often, it's the suffering of receiving the wrath, the judgment of God. That prayer recorded in the other Gospels of Jesus, who he says, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. He's not thinking of the cup of blessing. He's thinking of the cup of the fury of God's wrath. But he's finished that prayer. He's risen from that prayer. And he is resolved. Ringing in his ears, perhaps, that expression, not my will, but yours be done. He wants to do the Father's will. So he wants to drink the cup that the Father has given him. Knowing it all, knowing all that would follow, he comes out to face his captors because he says, I want to go through with this. Peter, don't interfere. I am drinking the cup that my Father has given me. He recoils at one level from the idea of the fury of God. He realizes that he won't just die a death, and it won't be painful, and it won't be cruel, and it won't be humiliating only. It will be the death of a man who receives the full fury and anger and wrath of God bearing down on him for those moments as he hangs on the cross. He knows that is the cup that he has to drink. Worse than a death, the fury, the wrath, the cup of God's anger. But knowing that, he still goes ahead. And I don't think we can or we should ever get over the wonder of that. That Jesus is determined to go to the cross for us. Peter wants to save himself and maybe save Jesus. So he gets out his dagger. Not quite sure what he expected to happen, whether he thought they could perhaps break out. Not sure quite his motivation, but he certainly doesn't want to go through with the cross. He doesn't want Jesus to go through with the cross. And he doesn't think the kingdom of God is about suffering, does he? He thinks it must be about victory. Sometimes we might think the cross is unnecessary for Christ. Sometimes our friends might say, well, it all sounds a bit cruel and barbaric, really, Jesus having to go to the cross. Did he really have to die in that way? And did God really have to vent all his anger on Jesus? But there wasn't any other way. And sometimes we then apply that to the Christian life and we say, well, the cross, that's fair enough, but for our Christian life, does it make any sense that we suffer? Surely that's unreasonable. Surely we shouldn't suffer. Surely the Christian life should be one of perpetual victory over every enemy and our own sin. Surely we should never fail. Surely we should never be persecuted. And these words of Jesus here say, for me, Jesus, the cross is absolutely necessary. And for you in your Christian lives, as you follow me down through the generations, as you follow me, Peter, and as all who believe in their witness, the witness of the disciples, as all who follow him face their trials, there will be the cross. And you won't be able to avoid it. You won't be able to get out of it sometimes. There is always the cross before the glory, before the crown. We suffer before glory. Suffering for Jesus leads to glory. Suffering for us leads to glory. So do you recognize that the cross was necessary for Jesus? And do you feel the wonder of it this morning? It's an amazing thing. You know, if somebody offered you something like tickets to go and see Bruce Springsteen, about 10 of you would probably like to go and see that, or to see some other of your favorite band, 2 free tickets to go and see that. You'd think that was pretty good, pretty sacrificial, but maybe they don't like him. He's got a bit of a gravelly voice and he's a bit of an old geezer now. Maybe if they offered to take an exam for you, you'd think, well, that's pretty good. That's pretty sacrificial of them, taking an exam in my place. But still, maybe some people like taking exams. They find pleasure in taking exams. They enjoy the thrill and the competition and all that. Maybe someone offers to go to prison in your place. That's pretty amazing. Maybe someone, as has happened in history, maybe someone offers to actually die in your place. That's extraordinary. That's awesome. But Jesus is orders of magnitude beyond that. He does so much more for people who deserve it so much less. It's for people who deserve it so much less and who have no relationship. It's like your worst enemy doing all those things for you, giving you the tickets, taking your exam, going to prison, dying for you. Your worst enemy doing that. But actually, it's worse than going to prison or dying. It's receiving the wrath of God for you, in your place, instead of you. And we need to never get away from the wonder of that. That the cross was necessary and that Jesus was determined to go through with it because it was his Father's will. And we need to then be wise about our own lives and to say, well, that was a one-off event. That was one thing that Jesus did that we will never repeat, but it does set the pattern for our lives that there will be suffering before this glory. Third, and the last thing I think that we can learn from this text, talking about Jesus' arrest, is that he does it so that no one is lost. Look at verses 8 and 9. I told you I am he, Jesus answered. If you're looking for me, then let these men go, the disciples. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. Just as a by the way, you notice how John here starts to use the words of Jesus in a form that he might use the Old Testament. So he's taking some words of Jesus and he's saying, this happened so the words will be fulfilled. I won't lose any of those. So he's taking Jesus' words and he's kind of using them like he might have been using the Old Testament scriptures. Can you see that? Often the gospel writers, they quote from the Old Testament. Something happens, they say this is to fulfill the words of Isaiah the prophet or Malachi or the Psalms. And he's doing this here with Jesus' words. Interesting, isn't it? He's starting to use Jesus' words as though they had the authority of God himself, as though they had the authority of Scripture. That's a by the way, but how he uses them is to show that Jesus wants to be clear that what he's doing here John wants us to be clear that what Jesus is doing here is fulfilling his own prediction that he won't lose any that have been given to him. He's already assured his disciples that all who the Father have given him are safe in his hands. As we looked at just a couple of weeks ago, as he prays in John 17, he says, I haven't lost a single one of those that you gave me. And John says Jesus is continuing to do that here. Judas has clearly crossed over. He's with the high priest's men, and he's with the soldiers. He's standing there on that side. Perhaps John is shocked and appalled. Perhaps it's an abiding memory kind of ingrained in his brain that as John witnesses these things, that he sees Judas. Judas is standing there with him. Incredible. But he has crossed over. And of course, that's not a surprise. Jesus knows that one will betray him. He says that's been destined. That's been predicted. That was always going to happen. But there are 11 who are standing there with him. And Jesus says that I'm not going to lose any of them. They're about to be scattered. They're very afraid. They're very impulsive. They're all messed up in their heads. But they won't be lost. They are with Jesus. And I think these words work kind of at the immediate and at the eventual. So in the immediate, Jesus is protecting the disciples from being arrested. So he saves them from being arrested. That clearly happens, that just Jesus is arrested. But I don't think John wrote these words just to say that. I think it works at a much deeper level, that John is pointing out that Jesus is continuing to fulfill that promise that he's going to protect them, and not one of them will be lost eventually. Not one of them will be arrested, but not one of them will be lost eventually. Jesus is saying, take me, let them go, so none of them will be lost. And of course, the statement is applied to that moment, but it applies to the work that he's going to do at the cross. Jesus will say at the cross, take me, let them go. Take me, arrest me, crucify me, so that none of them will be lost. Nail me to the cross, so they will go free. Let me be the one. And of course, John wants to remind us that that was inadvertently predicted. See that in verse 14. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Caiaphas, the high priest that year, says to the people who are gathered, back in earlier in John's Gospel, chapter 11, he says, you don't know what you're talking about. Don't you realize that it might be better if one man dies for the people? And he speaks so much better than he knows. And John wants to record that then, and he wants to remind us here that Caiaphas inadvertently actually understood what was going on. That one man was going to die for the people. That one man was going to die so that none of his people might be lost. So Jesus in his life, Jesus in his death, Jesus in his great authoritative power says, not one of them will be lost. And not one of them are lost. Jesus goes to his death so they might have life. Jesus rises again victorious so none of them would be lost. That's good to see and record, but it means so much to us this morning. Not one of us will be lost. None of his disciples will be lost. You Christian believer this morning, are you trusting in Christ? Have you bowed the knee in the way we were thinking about earlier? Have you understood the cross? You won't be lost. Jesus goes to the cross so you won't be lost. You won't be lost because of your sin, because Jesus dies on the cross to pay for your sin. You won't be lost because of God's lack of power. He is all powerful and Jesus has risen, exalted and victorious. You won't be lost because of God's lack of power. Your sin won't condemn you. Satan won't overpower you. Not one will be lost. Not then, not now. Do you understand what's going on here? Maybe the disciples didn't at this point. Later, John, as he writes these words and writes this story, He's obviously understanding what's going on, but maybe the disciples then didn't, but they were standing in the right place. They didn't understand everything, but they were standing with Jesus. Where are you standing this morning? Are you standing with Jesus? Do you want to be identified with Jesus? Or are you standing with Judas? Are you standing with those who are just saying, "Where's Jesus of Nazareth?" Or are you one of those who says, "I need Jesus to die in my place. I need to stand with him. I need to put my trust in him. I need to put my own sword down. I need to put my own schemes down. I need to put all my ideas down. And I need to say, what are you doing, Jesus? What have you done? What do you want me to do?" Is that you this morning? Do you recognize what's going on? It's a line of a song that says, "There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in." Or another song, "Amazing love, oh what sacrifice, the Son of God given for me. My debt he pays, my death he dies, that I might live." And that sense of assurance in a song that we'll close with in a minute. No power of hell, no scheme of man, can ever pluck me from his hand. Till he returns or calls me home, here in the power of Christ I stand. Is that you this morning? Standing with Christ, in the power of Christ, recognizing he's the eternal Son of God who went to the cross for you, and that trusting in him, you cannot be lost. Is that you this morning? Then rejoice in it. If that's not you this morning, then make today the day when you bow the knee to Jesus and put your trust in him. When you stop with your own schemes, you put everything down, you lay everything aside, and you say, "Today, I want to properly, seriously, forever trust Jesus." Excuse me, trust Jesus. Make today that day. Some of you have heard this kind of message, these kind of ideas so many times. Make today the day when you properly do something about it and put your faith in Jesus. He didn't let his disciples down. He won't let you down. Trust him this morning. Let's ask for God's help to do that. Let's pray.